This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Welcome to episode 187 of FilmWax Radio. This is Adam Shartoff, your host today. I appreciate your downloading me in this episode, or streaming it. That's your method of listening. I don't know. Most people, I assume, are listening on their phones, but kind of trying to figure it all out. So whether you're listening on your phones, your tablets, your laptops, your desktops, your what's left? Nothing's left. I think that's, I've covered it. I guess you could listen to through Roku or Apple TV as well. Regardless, welcome to FilmWax Radio. And yes, this is episode number 187. So much in the news in the independent film sphere this week. I mean, the Golden Globes were the other night. And they were okay. I kind of tuned in and out. I really don't watch that. And I only started in the last few years really watching the Oscars. And I just kind of felt like I needed to be a little bit more tuned in to that. But I tell you, it does not hold a lot of excitement for me. You know, I just look at a lot of filthy rich people giving themselves awards. You know, listen, there's much money to be made around the films, and people got to get paid. So I suppose, in part, that's what that's about. Some of those advertisers obviously pay the networks, and the networks seem to really need the money these days. So whatever. At least Amy Poehler and Tina Fey are, they're funny, and you can rely on them. They should host the Oscars too. I understand Ellen DeGeneres will be hosting on March 2nd when the Oscars are broadcast, but. Again, maybe that was a kind of a safer way to go than bringing back Seth MacFarlane. I don't know. I'm not really familiar. But I do remember the disaster they had a few years ago with James Franco and Anne Hathaway. So that's when they immediately brought Blake Crystal back from, retirement. Because that was a great thing to do. So, they're playing with different things, I guess. Oh, and Jon Stewart, didn't he do it a while ago? Anyway, enough of that. Watch that for a bit. Then I read in, of course, in the news that Armand White, the film critic for the now, I guess, defunct New York Press. I didn't even know that went out of business. I didn't notice it. I guess that's the thing. I used to, read them pretty regularly, and then I just sort of fell out of the habit. But he was expelled from the New York film critic circle for heckling. Directors for he was heckling Steve McQueen, I guess, and calling him names, and some of them weren't even names. I'm not sure how they were, why somebody's being called a doorman and a garbage man. I guess that's his way of calling Steve McQueen and Uncle Tom. I don't know. I don't even understand it. It doesn't even make sense. But he was thrown out on his ear, and of course now the internet is full of lots of rhetoric. So that was kind of an interesting thing to happen. And then just last week also, I don't know if I mentioned this on the last show, but the San Francisco Film Society's Ted Hope, who has been a big-time film producer of independent films for many years, was just made CEO of Fandor, which was pretty neat. And then I just read today that Ryan Werner, formerly of the IFC Films, has just been made a senior executive of publicity and marketing over at Cinetic. So that's kind of interesting. Let's get Ryan on the show. That was my first thought, of course. He'll come on. We have a nice relationship. Speaking of the industry, today's show is kind of a fun one. I have on Jeremy Boxer, creative director for Vilman Video over at Vimeo. They've got a bunch of things they've been launching, and I met him recently at Doc NYC. He participated in one of the panels that I helped produce, and then I asked him to come on to the podcast. He was very, very accommodating. I went over to the offices of Vimeo a few weeks ago, and we sat down for a nice long chat, and then he wanted to follow up with me. He had some thoughts, and so we did a brief phone call, and those things will be happening. Vimeo On Demand is one of the big initiatives that Vimeo has released in the last year, and it's already got a slew of independent film titles in their library. You can embed your Vimeo on demand on anywhere, and it's super simple, and we were going to talk about all these things and more with Jeremy Boxer in just a moment. Following my conversation with Jeremy is a filmmaker, Jillian Schlesinger, who made her first feature documentary called Maiden Trip. I saw it. Well, I didn't actually see it. I tried to see it back at South by Southwest last year, but I couldn't get into I couldn't fit it into the schedule. But I got to see it, and I was riveted. It sounded fun. It's about the youngest person in the world to sail around the world by themselves. She's a 14-year-old girl from the Netherlands. And she's a fascinating subject, and the story is gripping. So I met with Jillian in Brooklyn, and we had another longer chat. And so that's today's program. Yeah, so I think we should just get right into it. So I'll come back after Jeremy, and we'll just chat for a second, reintroducing Jillian, and then, of course, back at the tail end of the show to talk to you. Right now, my conversation with Jeremy Boxer from Vimeo. I can't stand it when you hold my hand. I can't stand it when you call me a natural lover man. I can't love it when you say, baby, please don't go. I don't need you, baby, because I want some more. I said, love me, baby, love me like I never did it before. Well, Jeremy Boxer, welcome to Filmax Radio. Thanks for agreeing to do this.
No worries.
Yeah. How long have you been with Vimeo, first of all?
Officially, I've been with Vimeo, I think, actually, 3 days will be my third anniversary.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thanks.
It's a bit of a milestone by today's standards.
Yeah, I guess so. In the internet world, it's probably like eons, but yeah.
Yeah, right. You're very seasoned. What were you doing before Vimeo?
Well, I had a series of different... projects. The longest tenure I had previous to Vimeo was working for Res Media Group and ResFest and Res Magazine. I was with them for on and off for the whole tenure of the 10 years. And after that, I consulted with a number of different companies, including Tribeca and a social games company called Hide and Seek, and worked on a number of different projects. And the reason I came to Vimeo was through a pitch process to help them develop the first Vimeo Festival and Awards. So I came on as a co-director of the first awards, and I was a freelancer at the time. And after the tenure of that awards season had finished, they asked me to stay on, and so I've stayed on since then.
And what was the appeal to Vimeo to you?
Well, it really...
Initially, I guess.
I guess initially, the appeal of Vimeo to me was it felt like it was a natural progression from what I had already been doing. I had worked in several different places that were prior to internet video, and so it felt like what Vimeo was doing at the time and where internet video was at the time was a convergence of all the different disciplines that I had worked on. So it felt like I could bring a lot to the table. I think I was employee number 18 or 20 here, and you know we're over 100 now. Wow. So it's been interesting to see and be a part of the massive growth of the company at that point.
Yeah. Let's get a little bit more specific about the identity of Vimeo and what you identified, you know, where you could fit in, and or maybe what those that kept you on identified as where you could help with that, and how Vimeo distinguishes itself in a landscape where there's a lot of companies coming and going. Vimeo seems to be, perception wise, which is pretty important, to become more and more of a stakes player in how people view films. And
well, let's take first my the context of me within the company. What at the time, I think what I brought was a connection to the outside film world, which previously it felt like Vimeo was more insular to the online video world. And so by creating the festival and awards, we bridged that gap a little bit more in terms of having people such as David Lynch and Morgan Spurlock and other people like that be our judges for the first festival, which enabled a much broader audience to maybe know about what Vimeo was at the time.
Because up to then, it was more of a filmmaker's
It was more of a filmmaker's tool, I think, at the time. And I'm not saying that the festival was a massive turning point, but it just happened to be at a point of inflection for the company. The other thing that was interesting to see is how at that time we all knew that Vimeo was going to grow and things were going to move forward because everyone was talking about how big online video was going to be for everybody. And this was back in 2010. So it was interesting to see and be a part of the company at that point and bring everybody that I had met up until that point and try and figure out how to integrate. In terms of the company and the company's growth, I think that we've really stayed true to our core beliefs from the beginning, where we consider ourselves the best in class player that's out there. We consider that we try and offer, no, we do offer the best tools that are out there for filmmakers to share their work and to enable for a frictionless exchange between. And what that has enabled is many of the world's best creators and up-and-coming creators and to create this community. And I really feel that the byproduct of creating the best tools is that we created this community, and in the community there's all this amazing content, and the three have kind of have cycled and have enabled the growth of the company, coupled with the needs for us to explore new avenues like Vimeo On Demand, which we launched in March of this year, and Tipjar and our whole creator services thing. The process of coming up with the tools to enable filmmakers to make money from their work seemed to be a natural progression from what we were doing. But we wanted to make these tools flexible for anybody who created video. So we also launched our new Pro product recently, which is enabling people to have much bigger accounts, much bigger storage, much bigger amounts and different tools to get to their audiences. So we've tried with everything we've done to service the community as well as grow the community as we're going.
So for a filmmaker who's using Vimeo, as so many seem to be, are they paying for an account?
Well, there's three different ways that you can use Vimeo at the moment. There's the basic service, the free service, which is open to anybody. And then Plus, which is $60 a year, and then there's Pro, which is $200 a year. With each one of them, there's limitations to what you do, but basically it's a storage and features increase with each one. The new Pro, for example, allows you to upload up to 20 gigs a week, which will give you approximately, if you do that every week, a terabyte over the year for $200, which we don't think that there's anyone out there who's allowing you to do something along those lines. Plus, there's a raft of tool sets that we enable you to do. And with Pro, you are able to use our Vimeo On Demand feature, which allows you to have ability to sell directly to audiences and make 90% of the profits.
In that case, you're competing with like an Amazon or
We're competing with different places that allow you to upload directly and sell directly to your audience without needing to go through a gatekeeper.
Okay. So, and that started in March, and how, yes. How's that been going?
It's been going phenomenally well.
Yeah.
We have been really surprised at how rapidly it's been taken up. We have been rolling out new features all the time, and we're going to be rolling out a raft of new features before the year anniversary. Mm-hmm. We're really, really buoyant about how it's been doing, and it's really interesting to see, like when we first launched the project, the interesting fact is that direct distribution was kind of a new idea. It had existed previously with filmmakers selling DVDs from their site. It had existed in one-off cases and other people doing stuff over the years. But the concept to filmmakers that were out in the field or at festivals or working out there, they didn't really, may not have thought about the process of how that they could sell directly to their audience or as a plan A or to augment what they were already doing or to enable them to find their audiences in new ways. So over the course of the past 9 months since we launched it, it's been interesting to see different filmmakers are actually thinking about it as part of their strategy going into festivals or going into their distribution plan instead of not thinking about it and adding it as a bonus.
Okay. Yeah. More of an afterthought. Is that
more of an afterthought? Yeah. So so when you actually think about direct distribution as part of your process to get your work out there, you can enable with the tools that we have, you can enable different things to happen along the way.
Is one of those tools where I have a new movie, I'm putting it out there for consumption, and I have a website, of course, and mm-hmm. right on the homepage, I mean, really, people—that's the best place for people to find it, I assume, mm-hmm. right? Is that so they can do a Vimeo on demand right on their website?
Yeah, what we've enabled with the tool is to enable them to sell off of our website. As well as their own,
okay.
So that we can have an off-site domain, so you can have the same exact pay page exist on your site. The other thing that is we've done is we've bonded the trailer and the film together. So wherever the trailer is shared, so for example, if your trailer is shared on Facebook, once you've finished watching the trailer, there'll be a button to buy now, and you'll right. be able to just click
most
right
logical,
to purchase.
Right, most logical thing. Like if I have somebody on and their film is going on demand, in whatever way that yeah. on demand is, whether it's on cable or online, or I don't post the show until
right.
you know it's already available. Otherwise, you lose that opportunity, don't you?
Yeah, I think the opportunity to have like as little time between hearing about a film and being able to purchase it
yeah.
is what's going to change it a lot for independent filmmakers.
Agreed, yeah. Earlier I said something along the lines of I think Vimeo is able to have a little bit more of flexibility for lack of a better word or term. I guess that's a great example of what I was like thinking about, that kind of where it feels as though the traditional or conventional film exhibition, and to some degree even digital distribution, is taking existing infrastructure, existing, you know, the way things have always been done, and trying to constantly, you know, add on that, like, you know, the extra room in the back and patch on to make things work smoothly. It seems as though Vimeo has the flexibility to continually create solutions that are much more practical and, you know, keeping up with sort of the way people do want to see the content. So
right.
they're coming from not only a filmmaker's standpoint, but also from an audience member's, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the concept when we designed the tools was to enable as much flexibility as possible. We have flexible pricing so that they are able to choose what pricing that they would like. We have the ability to choose where in the world that they want to sell it, so they can sell globally. They can sell globally except for one country. They can sell in just two or three countries. And they are able to also just decide where the film is placed. And so what that enables them to do is to really figure out a solution that is tailored for their film versus trying to fit into current solutions that are out there. So there are films that have existed on our platform that have been for sale that we never thought would be as successful as they were. Because on paper, if you would look at a 37-minute film that was sold for rented for $10 and sold for $15 about an extreme runner, you would say that's never going to work. But that was one of the highest sellers on our platform. So it's just because what they were able to do is place the film directly in the hands of the audience and the fans of that runner.
So do you think that this model works especially well for people making untypical movies? And untypical in the sense that it's a 37-minute film.
Right. I mean, I don't necessarily think that's... I think they work well for those. I think what this process works really well for is filmmakers who know how to reach their audience,
okay,
or who have a ability to understand their audience and understand how to get to them, and to look at a way of targeting the niches of that audience instead of going for a broadcast play. So like when I say broadcast, I mean a broadcast solution in terms of advertising, mm-hmm, or in terms of marketing, instead of using social media or using ways to get directly to the audience and putting the film directly in their hands, those films tend to do the best.
So is that a DIY mentality or approach to it?
Yeah, I mean, direct distribution requires the filmmaker to also wear the hat of a marketeer, or to enable them to give these tools to people who may know better than them and how to market the film.
How do they partner up then after the fact if they are building in Vimeo, mm-hmm, on demand experience as part of their initial plan? Then let's say PBS all of a sudden miraculously is interested in a 37-minute documentary on an extreme runner. How do then they does that, would that be an issue for PBS potentially, that it's on demand through Vimeo? Or
I guess if it's an issue for anyone, any distributor that comes along, there's two ways about doing it. There's either there's a situation where they could go dark on Vimeo for a certain period of time for their, mm-hmm, exclusivity for the PBS run, for example, or they could continue to sell directly from their own website, powered by us, and go dark on our platform. Depending on what is the needs of the filmmaker, what we really don't want the platform to be is something that limits filmmakers from opportunity. This right. was always designed as increasing opportunity for filmmakers, and it's never been a something like put in the way to limit people.
No, of course not. It's a way to liberate.
Yeah,
you know,
liberate is a better
way. Yeah, and so so you mentioned this documentary. This
sure.
And what's the name of that one?
It's called In the High Country.
In the High Country. Is there any other success stories that?
Well, I mean, one of the current success stories that we're looking at is a film that has chose to go exclusive with us, which is called Everybody Street. It's made by a director named Cheryl Dunn, and she worked with a company called All Day Every Day. They are a web agency, and they put together a whole series of different ways that the film would get out there. They used our tools, and they were able to sell directly from their website as well as on ours, and it's about street photography. So as an example, the articles that were written about the film were on websites like Gizmodo. So it hit a whole different target audience for that subject matter of that film that pushed the film into a different place. And because it's about street photography, and because Instagram is basically made everybody a street photographer, there's a conflux of like what the idea of these icons and what they looked at and how they shot that could be inspirational for everybody. And it seems like it's only been on the platform for 2.5-3 weeks, and it's picking up steam as it's going. It's been really interesting to see.
So yeah, it just definitely seems this is an ideal home for creative thinkers. You know, there's so many filmmakers that are still, again, trying to work, and they're beating down, you know, they're just beating themselves up to find distribution and ultimately to get a theatrical potentially. Mm-hmm. And the more I talk to filmmakers, and I talk to them all the time, these conventional of getting their film out there just don't really make much sense. It's too expensive. I find, you know, filmmakers often complain about that when they finish a film, then they have to go out there and then travel with the film, and you know, even if it's a theatrical, mm-hmm, which you think would be a great thing for a filmmaker, but they have to go often around, I'm talking about a certain level size film, of course, like most independent films, that they have to travel with the film through its theatrical around the country.
Make events out of it, all the stops along the way.
Yeah, meet the audiences. And I'm sure that's an exhilarating, very satisfying experience in some ways, probably. Yeah, but they're not getting paid for it.
No.
You know, they're not only not making money or not making another film at that moment, but they actually have to do a Kickstarter campaign or something mm-hmm. in order to finance them traveling around like a circus barker standing outside getting people to come in and see their film. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about the future for specifically again for smaller independent films, which there's so many of mm-hmm. Such a proliferation of. The obvious answer is, well, Vimeo's the future of...
Well, I mean, I think the real answer lies in terms of understanding what the landscape is going into your film. So creating a situation where from inception that you may have a plan to direct distribute in whatever way you want to do that, hopefully through us, that you would start to create extra content along the way. You would shoot the whole process of you creating the film. You would start a Kickstarter campaign that will start to build your audience as you're going and think about what you are going to do in order to create an audience with everything that you do along the process. So when it gets to you selling the film, you will have you'll have a predetermined audience that will already kick it going.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of people I've been talking to also that are panels that we're doing. That the one thing I'm also hearing a lot now is that the Kickstarter, more importantly than the money the financing you're raising, is the community you've created, and you know between Kickstarter or one or the other. I shouldn't just say Kickstarter. Fractured Atlas, whatever your platform is, and then also through, of course, Facebook, Twitter, other social media, that you're building this community, which is essential, and then it works almost seamlessly with when you go into it. That's what you're saying, like when you're going ready, right, and you're bringing them along and increasingly the community, right?
And I also feel like by having people fund a part of your process, they are also a part of your team. And so they convert from a normal audience member to an advocate. And
as long as they get their T-shirt.
Yeah, as long as they get their T-shirt and their download, you know,
right.
they will feel that way. But they move from audience member to advocate. And that's really what you want to do. And from advocate then to patron. I mean, you basically want to upscale your audience members so that they help you along the way.
And the stakes increase. I guess that's not the right way to put it, but they have a stake in it. So.
Well, they have a stake in it, and they feel a part of the process. And the people who are part of your team and who are the genesis of your initial audience just grows based off of that. So you're more likely to talk about a project that you're a part of than something that you've just seen. You know, it's more, you're emotionally more invested. So by having thought processes in that as you're going, and I've talked to many filmmakers who have used crowdfunding campaigns to strategically start that journey, but also worked with those crowdfunding campaigns to give them more tools to get their word out there. So by having a crowdfunding campaign, you have to keep updating your supporters. And by doing that, you're creating all this extra content. All that extra content then could then go to help market the film to a broader audience later. So it's a process as they're going.
I was going to ask you, what is something maybe that you're excited about that's on your radar?
Well, I mean, I'm really excited by some of the new tools that we're going to come out with, because I think that they will change the mentality of how people will distribute. I wish I could talk more about them publicly.
I understand.
But I'll update you soon about those. The other thing that I'm excited by is just the opportunity. The opportunity for filmmakers now seems to be... The film industry may be having issues, but the opportunity for filmmakers to reach audiences, there seems to be more and more and more opportunity. So I'm really excited to see who are going to be the really big successes that are going to come out of this methodology, and to really see those people who are going to become the new heroes for the next generation of filmmakers, who will then think, this is a way that I can do it. This is a way that I can finally get my story out there. In the same way that filmmakers have latched on to crowdfunding campaigns and how crowdfunding really seems to have come of age this year, it just seems that direct distribution is going to get there at some point, and we feel like it could be even next year. And it's exciting to see what are those projects that are going to do that.
You know, for the longest time, there's this direct, obviously, relationship between enormous marketing dollars and blockbuster films. Do you think there's any, there's a divide, and it seems like that breach keeps widening. And I just wonder if, I don't know, if you sense that anything about a traditional theatrical, if that's going to change at all. I mean, do you have any feelings about that at all? I mean, in a sense, maybe that's your competition. I don't know if that's your competition or if you seek it at all. Yeah. I don't see those two things reconciling.
You don't see like...
Yeah, the theatrical movies and where independent films are reconciling.
Well, I mean, I think where you will potentially be surprised is when the friction between getting to a theater for an independent filmmaker and the theater accepting a film shifts, you know, with projects such as, I mean, with companies such as Tug or Gather, and pushing that envelope of how to get films into theaters, and with independent theaters being able to screen digitally now and being able to literally have one screening be one thing and then the next screening be something else and not have to depend on runs. When theatrical becomes as flexible as online, which it will invariably have to be, that's when we're going to see interesting things happen with theatrical. I do think that theatrical, about bringing people together, there's not going to be something that is going to replace that. It's just a matter of where it sits and how it fits within the structuring of things.
Yeah, it just seems as a filmmaker, when I talk to them now, their last remaining impetus for them to do a theatrical, aside from, of course, that interactive experience, the experience of seeing audiences watching the film on a big screen, which is powerful, but they can do that in other ways, as you just described, through, in a way, the crowdsourced version of that, you know, get a crowd that's interested in a screening and launch a screening in a theater, is film reviews.
Yeah.
That's maybe a missing component. Would there be ways to get film reviews from Vimeo, from a Vimeo?
Well, I mean, I would assume that in the next 12 months, people are going to start to consider more reviewing things that are online across the board because of what amazing content there is out there in comparison to potentially the limited content that is out theatrically. So I would see a lot of people starting to write about amazing work. Amazing work always surfaces to the top, no matter what it is and no matter where it is. And so it's just a natural progression, I would imagine.
We are on the cusp, it seems as though.
Yeah, I think that we are on the cusp of that. I think that it's already been happening, and it helps with like the bigger companies just pushing that mentality of providing content direct for their audiences in whatever format that they want. But I do see that things are going to change as well. And in the same context, it's the difference between mass and controlling the audience of niches all over the world. So if you have thousands of people in different cities that are interested in one topic, the fact that you can reach all those thousands of people, their aggregate mass could be bigger for you than trying to do something broad in a smaller way. So you can focus your attention to the audiences of that would want your content. And that appeals and is a much more satisfying way of getting your content out there, because you're getting it to people who actually will care.
Well said. Jeremy Boxer, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, come back, please. Well, that was the first part of my conversation with Jeremy Boxer of Vimeo. We actually ended up doing a phone call a little while after that, because we were chatting on the phone, and he just updated me a little bit more on a few more details. So I thought I'd just put it up here. It's pretty brief, but there's a few details in here that you might find interesting, especially if you're considering using Vimeo on demand as a filmmaker, or if you're just kind of interested in somebody who is part of a conversation about where independent film is going to be seen, how more and more increasingly people are watching films. So here's a couple of minutes, a brief phone conversation follow-up with that I had with Jeremy just recently. Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
Hi.
One thing I'm kind of curious about is Vimeo on demand, how that's going.
So Vimeo on demand now is, I would say, about 5,000 films strong, which is...
How many?
5,000 films.
I guess I didn't realize it was already so robust.
Yeah, and it's quite amazing to see how quickly it got to be so big. And we are really proud to have launched something new, which is all focused on our new player, which is embedded transactions, which basically means that when the film and the trailer are bonded together, so wherever you share your film, you're actually sharing your trailer. And so when that it appears on any social network, or it appears embedded on any blog site or any review site, now you can purchase the film directly from the trailer. So it creates a much cleaner approach to using the virality of the net. And it enables filmmakers to really hit their audiences, really reach them actually directly where they need to.
So now if I'm a filmmaker and I've created a website for my film, I can now play the film right on my homepage.
Correct. You can, it really turns anywhere you embed the trailer, into a storefront.
And what does that retail experience look like?
The film page currently exists where you can embed it in one place off of Vimeo, as well as having it on Vimeo. How it would work with the embedded transaction is there's a new button on the right-hand side, which is the top button above the like button and above the share button on our new player. That button will lead you directly into a payment flow, which will pop up in a window on top of the trailer. A position for you to put in your PayPal or credit card information to either rent or purchase the film. If you have bought a film with Vimeo on demand beforehand, you have the choice to save your credit card information and just put in your Vimeo account details. So your account password and your account name. And if you have those two things, it will act as a payment unlocking as well.
That sounds pretty amazing. Certainly simple.
We launched this about a week and a half ago.
Anything else on your mind? I know that you had some sort of arrangement with the Toronto International Film Festival, where you are just digitally distributing a number of the films that premiered there this past fall.
We also announced yesterday, or the day before yesterday, the fact that we had 13 titles that have taken our TIFF deal that we put out in September of last year, which we're very happy about. And we're going into Sundance looking for more titles, and also going to be making some fun new announcements over the course of the next week. And we really look forward to hearing what people think about what we're doing. We're really trying with everything that we do to provide new opportunities for filmmakers to reach their audiences directly, as well as providing tools for filmmakers to solve the problems of distribution that may be facing them in the current landscape. Things are changing dramatically in terms of how a filmmaker can reach their audience, and we're trying to provide the best tools for them to do so.
Sounds like we're going to have a lot more phone calls to do over the next few weeks and months.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you like.
Yeah, well, I'm only being semi-facetious. I mean, actually, really, these are the exact kind of conversations that I do want to bring to the podcast. So I'm really grateful for our relationship here, and I'm glad you were able to make time to come on again. The podcast is about helping filmmakers, but it's also about helping viewers and getting through the noise and trying to figure out how to navigate all the content, all the noise. I had a recent conversation with a couple of filmmakers for a podcast coming up that was supposed to be like a 20-minute conversation, ended up being an hour and 45 minutes.
Which filmmakers were that?
Their names are Carl Jacob and Aaron Crumley. I don't think either of them has any of their features on Vimeo. But you do know that I had on both Jeff Marslet recently and as well as Alexander Rockwell and touched on the Vimeo On Demand. So
cool.
So clearly Vimeo On Demand has its value to filmmakers. Again, thank you very much for coming back on, and we'll stay in touch. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks so much.
I have a feeling I'm going to have him back on. First of all, he's making himself very available. He's a really nice guy. Just really generous. And so, again, thank you, Jeremy, for all that. And next up, again, is Jillian Schlesinger. The film is called Maiden Trip. It's opening at the IFC Center this coming Friday the 17th of January. Go check it out if it's playing in a theater near you or if you're in New York. I know Jillian will be at the IFC Center at least on Friday, probably a bunch of other screenings is my guess. She was lovely, and I'm really glad we were able to pull this off. The film is being distributed by my friends over at First Run Features, and they do a lot of great documentaries, so I hope they're happy with this, and I hope you too are listening and are pleased with this interview. I know I was. Jillian Schlesinger.
Here's an interesting controversy. A 13-year-old Dutch girl wants to sail the world alone.
Council for Child Protection's so concerned about the dangers of the voyage, it's asked a court to grant it custody of Laura.
Decker had to fight a 10-month court battle to be allowed to make that trip by herself.
Andere varen non-stop komt de wereld. Ik wil dat niet doen omdat je dan gewoon weinig van de wereld ziet. En heel leuk om andere landen, andere culturen te leren kennen.
All the other kids in school thought that I was crazy. I definitely preferred sailing for school.
I feel like freedom is when you're not attached to anything.
Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Test, test. Yeah. Oh, I don't even know how long is this?
3 hours and 45 minutes.
Oh, great.
Is that a problem?
It's too short.
I know.
Make it longer.
They shoot horses, don't they? You ever see that movie?
I've never seen it.
They shoot horses, don't they?
I know the title.
That was like Sidney Pollack's first feature, I think.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong.
Oh, wow.
Well, he might have done TV work.
That sounds right. Mm-hmm.
And I was reading in some book, 70s filmmakers, how he thought it was very self-indulgent. In retrospect, like he thought it was way too melodramatic.
Interesting.
I mean, sort of was, but it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be like...
I'll have to see it.
It's really, it's good. And to answer your question, by the way,
yeah.
We could do this in 20 minutes.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
perfect.
It could be a little longer. It doesn't really matter.
Cool.
But and I edited a little.
Idea.
Well, also, Jacob, you're going to have to like figure out what you're doing and not make so much like rustle. If you think you're going to make a lot of noise, you want to... Maybe you can... hold on one second.
It's not fair. I drag him along.
You're like, don't make noise.
You're an expert that you're turning how old?
How old are you turning?
On your next birthday?
When? When's that? Oh, okay. So you've got a little ways to go.
He sat in, like, many interviews, right? Yeah.
Is it ever fun?
Be honest.
Do you always have Legos?
Often.
That's great.
So, transitioning from one child to another.
Yes.
Well, welcome to the podcast, Jillian Schlesinger. Right? Schlesinger? Or
yeah,
do you go by Schlesinger?
However you pronounce it works for me.
You know, it's amazing how many times. I could probably play a montage of clips of people sort of saying that.
Yeah. And they're all different.
Well, it's just I would prefer to say it exactly the way you would say
so
it.
So I actually say it wrong. I say Schlesinger.
Okay.
But the correct way is to say Schlesinger. I mean,
oh,
that's
Schlesinger.
Like, you know,
that's the German?
Natively.
Or is
yeah.
It, or, oh, interesting. Okay.
So everyone in my family says Schlesinger. So Schlesinger. We're basically dropping the CH from the pronunciation.
Oh, I have the same, though.
Yeah.
And I have SCH in my name.
Oh, yeah.
Shartov. So it's the same. I have the same.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's like drop the S or drop the C, but it's a bit redundant
to
have both.
Indeed.
Especially, you know, when you're not even pronouncing the C, but that was a German thing, you know, even though I have no German lineage. Anyway, so it's a pleasure to have you finally to get together, do this. I know we've been planning this for a number of weeks. The film is called Maiden Trip, right? And I was at South by Southwest. And it was like, you know, I was doing my due diligence and I was trying, and I had, you know, read up on it and I was really trying to see it and couldn't fit it in.
Yeah, it was at a lot of faraway theaters, so I think that prevented.
That could have been it.
Yeah, it was very hard to get from there to the next thing and not miss the beginning of something else.
Yeah, like the Dulles Airport, you know, Alamo Draft House.
Yeah,
wait, isn't that where? That's Dallas, isn't it? Or something like that.
That was actually really fun. There's one screening that they do that's sort of a satellite screening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where you're, you know, more of the audience is from the community, and I really enjoyed that. That was
I bet. How was your South by experience? We may as well talk a little bit because I don't really talk about it, this part of it. That was your world premiere?
Yes. Okay. At South by Southwest. It was amazing. I mean, South by Southwest is a great place to premiere a film. I felt really lucky to be there. It was also very overwhelming because having never been through that experience anywhere, that's a very, very overwhelming place to be. So it was great. And it was, I think the nicest thing for me was just meeting other filmmakers who had gone through similar experiences where you're holed up in an edit room for 6 months or longer, and then suddenly you're out in the world with your project and people are seeing it. That's such an intense experience, especially for a first-time filmmaker.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to be able to connect with other people who are going through that same thing at the same time.
Did you, if there's things you can't talk about, just let me know. Did you also apply to Tribeca Film Festival? Or did you decide did you hear from South by Southwest and then decide not to apply? How did that work out?
So we were essentially just looking at things in the order that they came up on the calendar. And I was pretty firm once we got into South by Southwest that that's where I wanted the film to premiere. And I felt like it was the best home for the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really considered Tribeca.
Right.
But,
okay.
I mean, South By was, like, such a dream come true for me that it just seemed like the ideal thing to do for this particular project. I think there are also films that are better suited for other festivals, and it's just about, you know, finding the right match.
Yeah, very much. Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't normally think this, but I actually think Maiden Trip would have been good at Tribeca, too.
Oh,
I think it would have been a good... Because they do have these kinds of world documentaries, and in a way, even though this is obviously a U.S. filmmaker or U.S. filmmakers and a Dutch subject, but it's an international story on the backdrop level of it.
Yeah.
Let's say, you know, it's sort of a triptych of sorts, but it's very much about this young lady. And it's an opportunity now for you to kind of like flesh it out for listeners to the story a little bit. Like, what's your take on this, what this movie is about?
Oh, what is this movie about?
It's
about
the synopsis, according to
for me, it's about a young woman who has a very unconventional dream and sets out to pursue that dream, and in the process of attempting to become the youngest person to sail around the world, she also grows up and discovers things about herself and has pretty universal experiences of adolescence and coming of age, even though she's experiencing all of those things in a very extraordinary and remote environment and something that's really distant from most of our realities.
Mm-hmm. Well done. yeah. So that's the story on the surface. And let's talk about Laura a little bit more in depth if you can. I don't know. Again, I'm not going to apologize for you ahead of time, so I don't know if you may be quite open to this.
Yeah.
I don't know what your relationship is like with her or her family.
Yeah.
But just like when I saw it, I thought it was much more of this young kid. I don't know what I was thinking, because like that just how would an 8-9-year-old get around? I mean, it's ridiculous. Especially after having seen All Is Lost, to see Maiden Trip was quite, it was really good, in a way a primer on some level, to see, because, you know, you see the extreme, everything that could go wrong, and then all of a sudden you're seeing this young, vulnerable person. Mm-hmm. Vulnerable in the sense of the world is chaotic, mm-hmm. not vulnerable in terms of her personality. She's probably has as much fierceness and brevity as the Redford character did. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had on Alex Karpovsky, who's in the show Girls, on the show, my last show, and he was talking about how he's terrified of swimming in the night in the ocean.
Wow.
Yeah, like it's just the idea is terror. It's just huge and it's dark, you know, and he doesn't know what's in there, and he feels very vulnerable. And it is terror, even though she's not literally swimming in the water, but she's out in the middle of the ocean by herself. How does she do that?
You know, one of the things that was very interesting for me in getting to know Laura and getting to know more about the story was realizing how much being on the water and being out at sea is a part of who she is and a part of her life experience that's so different. You know, Laura is more comfortable at sea, or as comfortable at sea, as the rest of us are on land. And I think the way that the wide open ocean is portrayed in a lot of Hollywood movies and a lot of storytelling, we just get this impression of the sea as this endlessly scary, out of control environment. When in reality, when you have a relationship with the ocean like Laura, and the knowledge and skills that she has and that her father has to be able to plan a trip like this, you're able to make a lot of decisions that limit or minimize the risk and are actually things that many, many people are doing. So not just Laura, but there are other people sailing around the world with much less sailing experience than Laura has.
Adults.
And much less knowledge. Yeah. And doing so quite safely. There's a whole community that I discovered in the process of making this film. They're cruising sailors, and it's everyone from retired couples to young families, people who
really
have an adventurous spirit or an interest in sailing and want to live in a different way. And they sell their homes and they get on a boat and they go do this and they become part of this community.
And
so
pirates.
Laura, yeah, they try to avoid the areas with pirates pretty seriously.
I bet. No, it's, and as did she had, it sounds, it looked like she had on quite a bit of time onto her trip by doing that at one point, and up by the, when she was passing by Africa, that she had probably added more time on her trip by going further south.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely added time. And it was also, I think it was a good choice for her, not only in terms of the safety of not going in those areas by Somalia and up near the Red Sea, where there are a lot of problems with pirates, but also I think by that point in the trip, she was really seriously considering not going back to Europe. And with that plan in mind, it also was much more logical for her to go that route and cross the South Atlantic to go back to the Caribbean rather than going back to Europe.
Yeah. Okay. And so, a lot of people that do things like extreme adventuring like this often describe having a respect for nature, mm-hmm. and that people get in trouble when they don't, have that respect. And I don't know if that's a cliche or if that's something that Laura ever talked about.
No, I think that's definitely, I think it's a cliche that rings true. I think that when you're out in that environment and you spend time really engaging with the natural world, you develop such an awe and a sense of inspiration about not just, you know, what it looks like and what it feels like to be in it, but the fact that that all exists is so amazing. And I think when you're out there, you also see things falling apart in ways that we're a little bit removed from in our day-to-day lives. Like if you're sailing across the Pacific Ocean and you pass by a little pile of plastic in the water, like a clump of, you know, weird garbage, it's, you really think about that, and it feels like that natural space is being invaded or being hurt, and you want to work to protect it. Yeah, so sure. Laura, as a result, and also even before her trip, because she had this lifelong love of the ocean and sailing, she's been involved with Sea Shepherd.
What's and, that?
It's an organization that it's an activist organization that works for the protection of sea animals and natural environments, but mostly I think sea creatures.
Did she become?
They were really, yeah. Oh, I was just going to say they were really involved with the whole operation that you see in the cove.
Oh, very right.
Yeah.
That's Sea Shepherd. That's quite a documentary. Yeah. Is she by nature, or rather just by default, an environmentalist? You know what I'm saying? Like
yeah, definitely. I mean, I think she realizes that being in the public eye, and you know, to some degree, gives her an opportunity to speak up both for issues around the natural environment and especially the natural environments of the oceans, but also she does a lot of work related to youth empowerment and helping young girls to feel like they're powerful and capable and can go do crazy things, like, though not that specifically.
Yeah, she is a great role model in that way. So she is officially the youngest person to sail around the world alone.
Right.
Right. She made stops, of course, as we see in during the course of your film, in a few different countries. She took a break in order to, you know, just see the sights and to meet people and have a certain level of social engagement and whatever. But there are people that have gone, apparently, and this I found shocking, that have actually not stopped, right? That they've sailed around the world without stopping.
Yeah, and that, to me, I mean... They all sort of fall under this very broad category of sailing around the world, but the experience of sailing around the world alone without stopping is really just like an endurance race, you know, and it's a test of your ability to be alone for a very long period of time, but it's not the spirit with which Laura embarked on this adventure was just that, you know, an adventurous spirit. She really wanted to explore the world and see things, and didn't really understand the idea of why anyone would want to sail around the world nonstop or what you would gain from that experience. That said, there are people who do that, and it's extremely admirable and a huge accomplishment. It's just very far. I think the things that drive you to do each, even though physically, a lot of it's the same activity. The things that drive you to do each and the challenges associated with each thing are very, very different. So, for example, as a 14-year-old, spending 6 or 7 months totally isolated and alone is very different. That's its own challenge. And it's very different from the challenge of arriving in port, having to learn how to go through the process of immigration, having to do your own shopping and all
language
of these things. And meet people and make connections and know, you know, how to meet the right people and not get involved with the wrong people. And all of those things were a part of her experience that aren't things that you face when you set out to sail around the world without stopping, whatever age you are.
The story begins as she's attempting to get the trip planned and launched, and we learn that And by the way, I just want to say now before I forget that the trip was a 2-year journey.
Mm-hmm.
So she was you know, she left the Netherlands, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it ended up taking her about 17 months.
Okay.
But in the beginning, she set out for it to be approximately 2 years. But with some flexibility, I think she just needed to do it roughly within that time in order to be the youngest.
Yeah, depending on her emotional tailwind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
like, how fast was she going to feel like she could get back home? To finish my thought, the government tried to intervene and prevent her from going because, you know, she was too young. Mm-hmm. I don't understand exactly, you know, all the implications there, but she had to go to court to get permission, basically, right, that were happening?
Yeah, so
in the Netherlands.
In August of 2009, the Dutch government became aware that she was planning to do the trip when she was attempting to arrange a homeschooling program for while she was at sea. And after about 11 months of really in-depth interviewing and psychological profiling and a lot of extra preparation, first aid, and a variety of things that they said, you know, if you do this, that, and this other thing, then we'll give you permission to go. And earlier on, it sort of seemed, at least from Laura's perspective, like she was doing all the things that they were asking, and then they were just asking for more things. And so then eventually, you know, whatever was asked of her, she would do, and she would do with flying colors. And eventually she, you know, she was incredibly persistent, and eventually she was given the permission to go in July of 2010, and then left almost immediately.
Wow. So it took most of a year to jump through all those hoops. Now let's talk about the rest of her, you know, motives and whatnot. I mean, it seemed as though, as I think even you have referred to, she has a kind of a complex relationship with her parents. Without getting too dramatic, we all do. So it's just that very few of us go on a trip for 2 years, or have when we were that age anyway. So adolescence, I mean.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think that's a complicated time in everyone's relationships with their parents, or at least for a lot of people, certainly.
Most parents at that point usually are the ones that want to send their kids, or they themselves want to go on the trip to get away from their kids at that particular age. It's very rare where the kid is actually the one who wants to leave their entire social life behind.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think for Laura, she spent the first 5 years of her life at sea with her mom and her dad, and had, you know, very positive though limited memories of that time. And then they moved back to land briefly while when she was about 5 or 6, and then her dad and her mom got divorced. Mm-hmm. And she stayed with her dad because she wanted to be out at sea and in shipyards and sailing a lot. And that was when she started sailing alone at age six. And
she did some big trips on her own, but not.
Yeah.
Right,
and so I think in all of the time that she spent on land, I think it was for her more about just not feeling totally at home or part of the school community. I think she really identified with the sailing lifestyle, and that was what felt natural for her. So I think a lot of it was this very intense and deep-seated desire to be among people that she felt like were of her community and had the same values and thought like her. And I think it was very exciting when she actually was able to embark on the trip and started meeting all of these sailors and cruising families in the various ports. She finally was able to connect with people who had similar life experiences and who could relate to the way that she saw the world and wanted to go through it. And I think that's a nice thing, you know, whoever you are and wherever you're coming from, if you're in any situation where you feel like an outsider, I think to pursue and then find a community that you feel a part of is a really amazing feeling, especially as a teenager, which can be a very, you know, isolating and challenging time in life.
Right. Okay, well, now comes the logical questions that would come after seeing the film. And one, of course, is you weren't on the boat.
Right.
So you weren't on the sailboat. So you didn't sail around the world.
No. So I sailed across the Pacific Ocean on another boat, that was not planned.
Okay, but. Well, that's definitely yeah. does give you some an enormous perspective sailing across one of the oceans.
Oh, I was just going to say, having done that, I can't really imagine having made the film without that experience.
Right.
But, like, it wasn't a part of the plan of making the film at all. And now it just seems like, ugh, how did I think that I could tell this story without knowing what it's like to be out there for weeks on end?
But what was your reason? What was the circumstances?
Oh, it's actually a funny story. So we had met this Canadian family, a cruising family.
Again, cruising is somebody, is
cruising,
our family
yeah, cruising
that go on.
Sailors are just people who
go for sport or
yeah,
for rather
they're
leisure.
Just,
and,
they're just, yeah. you know, wandering around the world, and they go in the safest seasons for weather windows and you know, make sure that they're basically going along these routes at a time when, like, a lot of people are going along the routes, and and yeah, they, you know, it tends
safety
to be
numbers
pretty,
the weather's
exactly
best,
yeah.
most optimal blah blah
yeah.
blah. Okay, so
Canadians. I yeah, we had met them in Panama and then ran into them again in the Galapagos Islands. And one night over dinner, we were just joking about it. I think it was actually Laura's idea. She was like, "Oh, you should sail across the Pacific on Rhythm." Rhythm was the name of the other boat. And
wait,
then
so you
can
known
film
Laura.
Me somewhere in the. Oh yeah, yeah. I met Laura while the court case was going on.
Okay.
So
in 2009.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we met in 2010. I wrote to her.
Why?
I sent her a really detailed illustrated proposal and a long personal letter about why I wanted to make the film, and I had never made a film before, and we'd be, you know, embarking on this first time adventure together, and something about the proposal connected with her, which obviously delighted me. And I went and biked alone across southern Holland in order to go meet her and her dad on the boat where they were living at the time.
Yeah, because she wasn't as friendly to that other journalist that
right.
visits.
Yeah, that was not yeah. our dynamic, I think.
Oh, good. So you knew yeah. her, and then, and she went for it, and then she encouraged yeah. you to go on this trip.
Right,
probably
so 2010, at that point,
11?
Yeah, well, okay, so the nature of the production was that, so she left from Holland. I visited her twice in Holland before she left on the trip, and then during the trip, mm-hmm. I met up with her in St. Martin, Panama, the Galapagos Islands, and then mm-hmm. and French Polynesia, Darwin, Australia, Cape Town, South Africa, and then back in St. Martin when she finished the trip. So I was already meeting her in these places, but what ended up happening was it was so difficult to figure out when to go meet her that it turned out to be much cheaper to just get one-way tickets and then figure it out once I was there. So I only had a one-way ticket to the Galapagos.
Mm-hmm.
And we were joking about this over dinner, and then somehow the joke turned into a serious plan. And the idea was that at some point we would try to sail close together so that I would be able to film. And then, of course, Laura thought it would be really funny to race us because we were in a boat that should have been much faster, but she's such a great sailor that she had a little head start, and then she went really, really fast and beat us by a day. So I sailed across the ocean, never saw Laura, ended up on the wrong island or a different island from where she was at the other end, and then I had to hitchhike on another boat to get to her. So the whole thing was, you know, quite an adventure, but it was great to be so immersed in this community, in this world, and to become aware of this culture that I had no idea existed.
Right.
And to make, you know, not just a very close connection with Laura, but close connections with a lot of the people we were meeting. I think it really helped to tell the story in a deeper way. And actually one person we met sailing is staying at my old apartment right now.
The story
She's from
just
Belgium. They're like from everywhere.
Well, I bet. So you gave her a camera? I mean, what so, and then you went, she just shot. How much did
she
shoot? Tell me now about a little bit more of the technical aspects of how you, you know, edited the film.
She actually used her own camcorder for everything that she was filming on the boat at sea, and then I gave her some GoPros to mm-hmm. be able to mount on the boat, and then and then I gave her a Zoom sound recorder, and would give her lists of topics to talk about into the sound recorder so that she would have an opportunity to reflect and think about different things that maybe weren't as comfortable to talk about in an interview setting, but mm-hmm. being able to talk about them on her own was actually really a nice experience.
Liberating. And yeah. after a while, and, oh my God, she must have, because of the solitude, she must have really opened up in ways that, if let's say, I don't know, I mean, you couldn't have been on the boat. Obviously, you could have been tagging along in another boat,
right.
but she wouldn't even have that level of maybe openness about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like one thing that I think is so cool about the film and about Laura and what she's done is just that she was truly alone. Like people are, of course, they're like, oh yeah, this kid sailed around the world alone. But I think often they don't realize how alone she was. Like even though they hear that, they think, oh, but there was a follow boat. Oh, but there was somebody there to meet her on land. There was nobody. I mean, she sailed around the world. She would often joke that she would come into ports and other sailors who knew who she was would be like, I don't understand. You're like alone.
Yeah.
Not just alone.
Right.
And she's like, yeah, I'm alone. And so that's really fascinating because I think people tend to be so, you know, they think everything's a publicity stunt or everything
right.
is just for show. And mm-hmm. and this is one of those rare cases where it's the real deal. And so it was a pleasure to make a film about that and then to also really respect that aspect of it. You know, it obviously created a lot of constraints that everything from at sea was shot by Laura, but that's part of what's so beautiful and intimate about the way the story's told is that, like, that's, you know, this is the footage. You don't get the craziest storms when the only person shooting is the 14, 15, 16-year-old who's out there alone.
Right.
You know, she can't have the camera out during those moments.
No, and she's like...
Yeah, and staying true to that is kind of, you know, I think that's a nice aspect of the way the story is told because so rarely do you see that, especially in seafaring stories.
Yeah.
You know, with like CG waves and all kinds of crazy effects.
Wait a minute. Effects. All is lost. What? That really happened on him. There have been a lot going back. I was thinking about it because there was the Castaway started with that, Life of Pi more recently. Mm-hmm. Now All is Lost. And even Kon-Tiki was the story of the documentary was remade as a narrative film last year.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fascination with these stories, but none that actually where there's one person going off.
Yeah,
Jacob, this young woman,
not,
she's 14 years old.
And certainly not women. Yeah.
Right. She's a 14-year-old girl, like some of your middle school kids at school. She went on a boat. She took a sailboat around by herself, around the entire world by herself.
Isn't that crazy?
Could you imagine doing that? Come on, say something.
Please. Do you want to see the movie?
Do you want to see the movie she made? This is Jillian. She made it with this girl who sailed around the world. and she was like 14. It was over. She was 16. She had two birthdays on the ocean by herself.
Yeah, she's only a few years older than you.
Can you imagine doing it? But by the time she was your age, she was already taking big trips. Can you imagine? That's crazy.
Alone. With her dog.
Can you imagine going, but still, taking a trip across, or let's say around part of a country by yourself? Unbelievable. I can't imagine him even taking, he doesn't even take the
I bet he would
subway.
Like it. Jacob, would you want to go on a long trip by yourself? And go exploring and adventuring?
How long do you think you could be by yourself? How long do you, he's not submitting. He's not going to be.
You'll probably talk about
it.
He's
not going to be bullied into being on my podcast. Yeah. So she shot as much as she did. Mm-hmm. How much footage did she get over the course of those 17 months?
Between what we shot and what she shot, it was like over 100 hours. But a lot more of that was the very limited footage that we shot when we met her in ports or when I met her alone in ports. She shot a lot more towards the beginning of the trip.
Right,
and
makes
actually
sense.
As the trip went on, it was really interesting because in the beginning, she shot a lot of straight to camera, sort of video diary style footage. And then she started to not do as frequent updates, but she would do really playful and interesting things with the camera. And I was really happy to have had no part in that. You know, I didn't tell her what I thought she should film or how I thought she should film or how long to hold on stuff. And she just, she had such an interesting and very intimate relationship with the camera, and I was glad that I didn't try to do anything to interfere with that.
And then she came back, and then it was, did she have any input on the...
She spent a month living with me here in New York, and we brought her in for a lot of the edit sessions while she was here, and got the film, I think in the time she was here, to like a pretty solid rough cut. And it was great because I think in a typical situation, it'd be very hard to have the subject of a film in the edit room that way. And in this case, because the film tells a very subjective story and is really just about her point of view, it was very valuable to hear her point of view on every aspect of what, you know, what story the film was telling, whether it felt true to her. I think there was a huge challenge, obviously, of taking 2 years of time and putting it into 80 minutes. It's obviously impossible for any film to feel like it tells the whole story of everything, or that every aspect of it is perfect in her eyes. And I think there are a lot of things that she really loves about it and feels proud of, and there are some things she's not as crazy about.
Yeah.
And
in terms of how she comes off?
Yeah, I don't think she minds so much how she comes off. I think there are particular scenes that she is not as happy with, but I think she...
She's smart, and she
I think as a filmmaker and a collaborator on the project, I think she feels very differently than she does as the person who the film is about, as the subject. And I think, you know, that seems like a really complicated set of lenses to look at the film through, but I'm really, really proud of how brave she was in telling her story and, you know, letting herself be shown in such a challenging period of life, from 14 to 16, letting herself be shown so intimately and sharing so much of that journey. I think it will be very inspiring for a lot of people, and I think she recognizes that.
Last question how did she change... In your estimation, what was the biggest change maybe you saw, or most significant change you saw?
You know, it's interesting. I get that question all the time, and I never answer it. And here's why. I feel like that's a very hard question to answer, because I think you grow up. It's such a constant and ever evolving process, going from childhood to adulthood. And I think it's very difficult for me to boil down that very huge and complicated process into like a few small, you know, like it's very hard for me to do. And also I feel like everyone, it's something that I like about the way that people react to the film, is that people tend to observe so many different things. So I'm always really reluctant.
Sure. Well, that's an answer.
Yeah.
It's an answer. Well, let's make sure we mention that Maiden Trip will be premiering in New York. It will have a theatrical engagement starting the Friday, the 17th of January.
Yes.
At which theater?
At IFC.
At the IFC Center.
Yeah. On 6th Avenue and 3rd Street.
On West 3rd Street. That's right. Yeah. And you'll be there on Friday?
Yeah.
And,
a lot of people. We have people coming from, I think, all over the world to be there. Laura, unfortunately, will not be there.
No.
But a lot of the crew and people who worked with us in various locations will be there, which is very exciting to be able to share this with them, because it's been a long time coming. I mean, I first read about Laura in August of 2009, so it's been over. Yeah.
Almost. Yeah. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming
having
on.
Me on. Yeah.
Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean in the Charleston Bay. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean in the Charleston Bay.
You know, I would love to sail around. I would love to sail just, you know, up to Albany or something from New York. I mean, right up the Hudson or something. I'm just desperate for a vacation. If you want to take me on your trip, I'm very, very portable. Like I can make the bed, I can make the coffee. All you have to do is get me a ticket and, you know, pay for my room and board, and I'll go along with you. There you go. That's the show. This show couldn't exist without people listening to it. Of course, that just makes sense. If a tree falls in the woods, somebody has to be there to know that it fell so they can say it made a noise in the first place, I suppose. I don't know. Try to figure out what I mean by that if you dare. I'm making my plea every show to please, if you aren't subscribed to this podcast, it takes only a moment to go to iTunes and subscribe. If you do it through your tablet or your iPod, I think you just go to the App Store and you can, if you don't already have a podcast app, get that, and then you can download. And there's so many other great podcasts out there. I'm not even, you know, I'm only too happy. You know, Mark Maron has WTF, and there's all sorts of others. Joe Rogan has a very popular show, and The Nerdist is very popular. There are so many. You know, I know I'm not in that or on that plane, that level of an audience in terms of size, but you know, to me it's the quality of my audience, and you know, if it's mostly comprised of people who care about art and great films, and if you're in there, then you know you're very valued indeed. And if you're, you know, just enjoy the show for whatever reason, I really, really appreciate it. So if you could do me a kindness, just subscribe to the show. You know, we're on Facebook, of course, so you can go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio and like the page. You can certainly leave comments. You can reach me directly at adam@filmwax.com, and keep it polite, but by all means send me a note and I promise I'll reply. Okay, so we'll be back next week, by the way, with returning guest Nathan Silver and his film Exit Elena, and then we'll be back again after that. We've got a few other big time shows coming up. One with, of course, the one and only Hal Hartley. That's coming up real soon, too. Thanks for listening. This is your host, Adam Shartoff. You've been listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films.